Welcome to X Squared Radio.
The spice expands consciousness. The spice is vital to space travel.
Welcome to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live this January 22nd, east of the Appalachian Mountains from an undisclosed location. Our AccuWindow forecast, somewhere around 40 degrees. And we don't know what's going on out there with the weather. Our AccuWindow forecast is all messed up tonight. But we're glad you're here with us live. The solar wind is whipping up to 432 kilometers per second. And there are 6 sunspot clusters on the sun today. The proton count is still high at 4.0 per cubic centimeter. Arriving later than expected, a coronal mass ejection hit Earth's magnetic field. According to analysts at the Goddard Space Weather Lab, the impact strongly compressed Earth's magnetic field and briefly exposed satellites in geosynchronous orbits to solar wind plasma. Shifting lines of magnetic force induced a strong ground current in Norway and sparked bright auroras over the upper reaches of North America. You know, lots of people up there have never seen an aurora, and so they're making regular trips as they're now in the midnight sun. I don't know why I'm getting a little bit of overmodulation here. Let me see if I can fix this by going to my... Let's see what I can do here. Oh, yeah. And we'll take that down to right there. There we go. Now we should be in good shape. Okay. Anyway, they're making regular trips up to the North Country to see the auroras at night. Evidently, it's quite the lifetime experience. If you want to join our program tonight, you can call anywhere in North America, 888-429-5471, 888-429-5471. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, you can get to a cell phone tower. You can get to us at 530-413-6472, 530-413-6472. Lots in the news. Not just weather-wise, but also the strangest political science going on right now. If you want to call in and express your feelings about that tonight, I would be more than happy to discuss it. Because there are so many parameters playing in the press, playing with politicians against one another. In my career, either on the air or as an observer, have never seen a political race like this, a primary like this, where this late in the game, we now have 4 candidates. All 4 candidates look very strong in their own right. Ron Paul is in a class by himself with his very energetic supporters. Lots of money flowing in from the military, which is kind of strange, seeing as how everybody feels that his foreign policy is way off base. And then we have the other 3 candidates who are playing the strangest game of cutthroat chess that I've ever seen, fighting each other and fighting the current president and the situation that we have, and also fighting the press. It is the neatest mud wrestling that you have ever witnessed. If you haven't been watching these debates, you're really missing some great entertainment. I want to talk a little bit about that tonight if you want to. By the way, you know how a windy day will clean the leaves off the yard. You don't want to get out there and rake the leaves off your fall yard. Don't worry about it. The wind will pick up and it'll blow it all over to your neighbor's yard. Well, increasing solar activity cleans up, you know, satellite debris as well. Earth's atmosphere has been puffing up in response to increasing levels of UV radiation from sunspots. Now, that's from the sun. This is good news for satellite operators because it kind of cleans the debris out of the way, helps cleans up low Earth orbit. The number of cataloged debris in Earth's orbit actually decreased during 2011. You remember we had a great program. We were talking about creating jobs by sending up space junk people with their shopping carts with various things from Velcro to large nets to magnetic vacuum cleaners to kind of pick up space debris that's up there and bring it back to Earth and sell the precious metals, even sell it back to the original owners because, by space rules, they're responsible for their own debris. But, well, you know what's going on. Nobody is cleaning up their mess. But the solar wind is kind of helping things out. And it even gets more mysterious, according to Nick Johnson in NASA's Orbital Debris Quarterly newsletter. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. There's a newsletter about space junk. Official. He says, even though only 6% of the total 3,218 catalog debris from the ill-advised engagement had re-entered by the end of 2011, half of them, fell out of orbit in the last 12 months. Why? He goes on to say, likewise, many debris from the 2009 accidental collision of Cosmos 2251 and Iridium 33 are accelerating their departure from Earth's orbit. In the absence of a new major satellite breakup, the overall orbital debris population should continue to decrease during 2012 and 2013, close quote. Well, low orbit will get quite a bit safer for those projects we want to launch. No one has given much thought to what will happen to all the satellites in orbit if the solar wind is joined by a powerful galactic wind. Who knows? Maybe low orbit was cleaned up once before. That's why there weren't any satellites up there when Sputnik launched. Maybe they were cleaned up during the last zenith of human existence. Maybe we're not the first ones on the block. Just interesting stuff up there. You know, that stuff's supposed to kind of fall out of space at a predictable way. But lately, it's been accelerating. So lots of people are wondering why that is happening. Why is the formula changing? Well, that's why, because the solar wind is unpredictable and it's been kicking up to all the way up to about 750 kilometers per second, which is, a cosmic tornado. But we also have galactic wind adding to it, stripping things out of space and moving things around. Kind of makes you wonder why the moon is the way that it is. Just interesting stuff, you know. The moon is out there. It revolves around the Earth once approximately 28 days. It also turns on its own axis every 28 days, like the same sign always faces us. It's just strange. You just don't see natural satellites put into orbit that way. Now we have the moon, which apparently is a natural satellite, but acting very unnaturally. Now, you have heard about the great snowstorm in Alaska. It happened just after last weekend. It wasn't just a little bit of snow. It was a whole bunch of snow. Well, the snow into Thursday could end up being one of Seattle's biggest snowstorms on record. The storm and its heavy snowfall have the potential to close passes in the Cascades, clog streets at sea level with tons of snow and slush, and force flight delays and cancellations, which it did. Near the coast, the snow will be heavy, wet, and difficult to shovel. It'll also be heavy on roofs, depends on where you're from. The combination of heavy, wet snow with gusty winds in some areas will down trees, take power lines with them. Lots of people are without power, and in the lower altitudes, it just turned into rain. So in Seattle and Portland and all around, we're getting just strange weather. We're going to cover a little bit more of that tonight, too. In the mountains, a yard or more of snow will fall in the high country. And the combination of the excessive snow now and rising temperatures late in the week will increase the risk of avalanches. The heaviest rate of snow will hit Seattle Wednesday of last week, when the snow would come down at an inch per hour for quite a while. And, you know, in Alaska, they got 20 feet of snow. That's heavy, even for Alaska. It was, took a while to dig out, and they got even more. And there's a little bit more strangeness in the weather later on in tonight's program. Right now, I want to let you know that at our 6 o'clock hour on the Pacific Coast, we have Sandra Sabatini coming on with the Pythagoras Conference. Why is that important? Because this is really a mega conference for the Midwest. It's never been done before, and we have a great affinity here at X Squared Radio for people who have never, who are attempting things that have never been done before. There have been little conferences, you know, little paranormal conferences around the Midwest, but most of the big conferences are definitely on the West Coast. You see them in San Jose, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and of course Los Angeles. But you don't see them in the Midwest, and that is a little hard for the rest of the country because it is difficult to squeeze out of one's budget the money to go to a conference. It can be anywhere from $300 to $500, but also you got to scrape together the money for airfare and hotel and a rental car and then all those meals. And, you know, before you know it, you're, for a couple people, you're up to $2,000 for a conference, and most people just don't have it. So the Midwest doesn't participate. However, this year, Sandra Sabatini and her crew have really put together a mega conference for the Midwest, and it's going to be in outside of Louisville, maybe just over the border in Indiana. To find out more about it, all you have to do is go to xsquaredradio.com and click on the Pythagoras Conference banner. It's the blue banner. You get $100 off, by the way, if you click now. Click on that, get signed up now, and we're going to have between 20 and 50 speakers. I know that it just boggles the mind that in 3 days you could have that many, but the way it is set up, it allows lots of people to come to this. Now, a lot of people don't know this, but Louisville sits in the middle of 73% of the population of the U.S., and it isn't like Los Angeles, where it's way over there on the left, I mean West Coast, and usually only those that are in L.A. Go to these things, maybe within driving distance. A few people will fly in, especially if they're associated with the speakers. But in the Midwest, you're within driving distance of this event. If you live in Chicago, if you live in Atlanta, you're within driving distance of this. So this is a really rare opportunity for you to participate in something where you don't have to pay for airfare. And the best speakers in the country are going to be there. So go to the Pythagoras Conference link at xsquaredradio.com and click on that blue banner. And you get $100 off. And believe me, it's a heck of a value. When you look at the speaker list that's going to be there, you've got Michael Cremo, you've got Ed Close, you've got you know, lots of world-class speakers going to be there that you don't get a chance to see unless you're willing to buy a $400 or $500 plane ticket each and fly to the West Coast. So there's your chance. More news tonight. You've heard about the killer flu being designed. Oh, yeah, yeah, designed now. They're taking the worst strains of the flu and collecting them, concentrating them. Why? Well, because they want to develop a cure, I'm sure, just in case one of the nasty little beggars gets out or should happen to get into the wrong hands. We have some kind of vaccine to help with it. Well, the killer flu designers are protesting about U.S. censoring. Yeah, we're censoring their design. America should not be allowed to dominate the debate over who controls sensitive scientific information that could be misused in biowarfare terrorism, say the scientists who created a highly dangerous form of bird flu virus in a study that has been partially censured by the U.S. government. I mean, it's a little bit like owning Norton Antivirus and also having a department that creates viruses. and sends them out all over people's computers so that they have to have antivirus software. And so you're kind of making your own market. Well, that's what these guys are doing in the white coats. They're sitting in the back room making up all kinds of lovely nasties and then creating the vaccines to fix them. And then only the ones that can afford the vaccine will actually survive. Sounds like a great business, doesn't it? Well, Ron Funchier and Ab Osterhaus of Erasmus Medical Center in Rotterdam accept recommendations by the U.S. government's National Science Advisory Board for Biosecurity, which said key details of their U.S.-funded research should not be published because bioterrorists may use the information to cause a bird flu pandemic. Quote, "But we do question whether it is appropriate to have one country dominate a discussion that has an impact on scientists and public health officials worldwide," Fonchier and Osterhaus write in the journal Nature. They go on to say it is not clear whether an international discussion would lead to different recommendations. We don't know the worldwide opinions until a group of experts from all parts of the globe is formed. An issue this big should not be decided by one country, but all of us, they say. That sounds a little French to me. I don't know. As the Independent report reported in December, Dr. Fonchier and colleagues created a strain of H5N1 bird flu. You've heard of H1N1, a virus that can be spread by airborne transmission between laboratory ferrets. That's just doesn't sound right, ferrets with the flu. Ugh. The standard animal model for human influenza. They did it to see how easy it would be for the virus to mutate into a form that could cause a pandemic. Wonderful, wonderful experimentation. Details of the genetic mutations could prove vital for scientists engaged in the early warning surveillance of new strains of the flu virus, as well as researchers involved in creating new vaccines and antiviral drugs. But the details could be misused by rogue states or by biowarfare terrorists with access to rudimentary scientific knowledge and fairly standard laboratory equipment and, of course, ferrets. Previously, it was thought the H5N1 bird flu virus, which appeared in birds in 1996, could only be transmitted to people by close contact with infected poultry, chickens, rather than by airborne transmission from one person to another. If the H5N1 bird flu strain mutated into an airborne form, it would result in one of the deadliest pandemics in history, where more than half of those infected die, a mortality rate that would dwarf other flu outbreaks. But so far, most of the 600 or so deaths from the H5N1 have resulted from close contact between people and poultry, and have occurred almost exclusively in Asia and the Middle East, where keeping domestic poultry around the house is common. Dr. Fauchier and Professor Osterhaus were among experts asked by Nature to give opinions on recommendations of the U.S. National Science Advisory Board for Biosecurity, which wants key details of their study, such as the precise genetic sequence of the mutated virus, to be withheld from publication. Lynn Klotz of the Center for Arms Control and the Nonproliferation in Washington and Ed Sylvester of Arizona State University say the chances of a laboratory strain of H5N1 escaping into the wild remain high if it is stored in conventional flu virus labs. Regulators should not be sitting idly by while the threat of a man-made pandemic looms, the scientists say. I'm sure it would be a lot safer in a government weapons lab, don't you? By the way, also in the news, a new super flu shot is going to be coming out next season. Evidently, researchers have been able to do genetic genome research on almost every strain of flu, and the part that mutates is the part that medical researchers have been responding to for decades, but the part that doesn't mutate, the actual root of all of the flu viruses, is what they're building a vaccine against. So this is the part that doesn't change. It's sort of like the trunk to any fruit tree. So if they master this flu shot, you could get one and then maybe a booster every 5 years, and you'll be literally immune to every form of flu ever known and that could ever come from the root genetic makeup of the flu. Sounds interesting, doesn't it? Or does it? I mean, a lot of you people are very mistrustful of the pharmaceutical community. They, you know, make the most of diseases by creating treatments for symptoms rather than cures for disease, a la, you know, diabetes, a la, you know, most of the other chronic diseases that you have to have medication for life for. When most people believe that somewhere back behind the door, there's a cure for that that can actually get your organ making what it's supposed to make, whatever it is you lack. And some of you may have some opinions about that. You can call me toll-free anywhere in North America, 888-429-5471. Anywhere else, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can get to us, 530-413-6472. Now, you've heard us talk about climate change a lot on this program. Much political hay has been made out of the term global warming. I don't need to repeat any of that. But the man that's really in the center of the crosshairs is named Michael Mann. We've invited him to come on the program, but he has not responded. I think he's a little paranoid about appearing in the press because he's excoriated on a regular basis. However, he is one of the most, you know, vilified men in the highly vilified field of climate science. Yet Professor Michael Mann is surprisingly jolly, despite being the focus of a brutal campaign orchestrated by the fossil fuel industry and senior politicians within the U.S. Republican Party. Mann's cheery stoicism is positively infectious. He says, "I've been the focus for attack by those who deny the reality of climate change for so long that it almost seems like forever." He's a professor of meteorology at Pennsylvania State University. He goes on to say, "I'm a reluctant public figure, but I have embraced the opportunity to communicate the science." Mann became a chief target of the climate change contrarians for being the outspoken author of an iconic graph of global warming, science knows as the hockey stick, the most politicized graph in science, according to the journal Nature. It was the hockey stick that generated much of the opprobrium heaped upon climate scientists as a result of the ClimateGate emails stolen from the University of East Anglia and leaked on the internet 2 years ago. Indeed, many of the leaked emails were copies of correspondence between the UEA team in the UK and Mann and his colleagues in the US. Mann believes the theft of the emails was not the work of a random hacker, but part of a sophisticated campaign. He says it was a very successful, well-planned smear campaign intended to go directly at the trust the public had in scientists. He insists even though they haven't solved the crime of who actually broke in, the entire apparatus for propelling this manufacturer's scandal onto the world stage was completely funded by the fossil fuel front groups. The hockey stick graph appeared to demonstrate how world temperatures had remained fairly steady for several hundred years before shooting up at the end of the 20th century, just like the straight blade jutting out from the shaft of an ice hockey stick. The analogy doesn't quite work with a curved feel hockey stick, but it does work with a nice straight one, and then boom. The original study was published in Nature in 1998. That's when global warming actually reached its peak. Within 5 years, Mann had become the focus of an orchestrated campaign to undermine the entire field of climate science by rubbishing the hockey stick, a term coined by a colleague rather than Mann himself. Republican Senator Jim Inhofe picked up the hockey stick to beat climate science, famously declaring in 2003 that global warming is the greatest hoax ever perpetrated on the American people. That was Senator Jim Inhofe. Mann became the target of Freedom of Information requests and was served with a subpoena by Republican Congressman Joe Barton demanding access to his correspondence. This was followed with a further subpoena from Ken Cuccinelli, the Republican Attorney General of Virginia, and yet more Freedom of Information requests from industry front organizations, notably American Tradition Institute. Climate contrarians argued that Mann and his colleagues were concealing their research methods because they had something to hide. In reply, Mann insists that he has been as open as he can about data and methodology, but the aim of these requests has been more to do with intimidation than openness. What they are trying to do is blur the distinction between private correspondence and scientific data and methods, he says, which, of course, should be out there for other scientists to attempt to reproduce. He goes on to say, I think it's intentional and malicious. It's intended to chill scientific discourse, to intimidate scientists working in areas that threaten these special interests. It's the icing on the cake if they can also get a hold of any more private correspondence that they can mine and cherry pick. It's a win-win for them. So why an obscure graph published in a scientific journal should enrage so many people has been the subject of much internet conspiracy, not the least of which has been on several competitive radio programs beside X Squared Radio. We've looked at the data one way and the other. It appears that Earth's temperatures were rising up to 1998. They leveled out in 1998, but what's happened in the last 14 years is that although the average temperature seems to be the same, plus or minus maybe a tenth of a degree C, the extremes between what is considered cold winter and what is considered hot summer have become nothing short of amazing. Normally we see something like 100 degrees difference between the very cold and very hot, and now we're seeing somewhere around 140 to 145 degrees. That is nothing short of cataclysmic. What we are seeing is that glaciers are growing, water temperatures are changing, habits of fish are changing, migratory patterns of birds are changing, different kinds of plants that grow on trees, like spores and fungi and things like that, are some are going extinct, and some that have been extinct supposedly for a long time are coming back because the temperature ranges are such that it creates a different environment, a different ecology, and so different life forms begin to flourish. Faced with a lack of formal temperature records before the 19th century, unfortunately, nobody had a thermometer in the 1800s. They attempted to use proxy records such as ice cores, tree rings, and changes to coral reefs. Because of the nature of the approach, their graph showed large error bars, which were drawn even wider apart the further back in time they went. But of course, you're going to have a lot of error. You're going to have more snowfall. You're going to have colder temperatures. You're going to have volcanic eruptions and things like that that end up in trees and ice all over the world. Many, indeed, most climate scientists have argued that the hockey stick graph is not central to the case for the role of man-made pollution in exacerbating global warming and the prospect of dangerous climate change, but it has nonetheless become the iconic smoking gun for both sides of the debate, showing either that we are living through unprecedented temperature increases or that we are being duped by the biggest scientific hoax in history. When we first published our Nature article in 1998, Mann says, we went back six centuries. A year later, we published a follow-up going back 1,000 years with quite a few caveats. In fact, the caveats and uncertainties appeared in the title, and the abstract emphasized just how tentative this study was because of all the complicating issues. He says it's frustrating that to some extent, all of that context has been lost, and the result has been caricatured. Often the error bars are stripped away, making it appear more definitive than it ever was intended to be. But if the aim of the climate contrarians was to browbeat man and his followers into submission, then it clearly has not worked. He is publishing his own book on the hockey stick controversy later this year. We'll have him on the program if we can get him on, and we'll talk about his book. And he shows every sign of continuing the battle. Scientists have to recognize that they are in a street fight, he warns. So, interesting stuff on the front of climate change. We've often said global warming, maybe not, but climate change is upon us. It doesn't take a rocket scientist or a meteorologist to see that. Go around the planet, you can see it. Go up into the extreme latitudes of the planet, and you can see it. Go into the desert, and you can see it. Go into the glaciers of the Himalayas, and you can see it. I've been there. I photographed it myself. So it's there. It's happening. Further in the news, by the way, at the top of this hour, we have Sandra Sabatini coming on with the Pythagoras Conference. She is a pioneer in the field. As you know, last year, she was supposed to have the 11-11-11 concert conference in Louisville. And just as things were heating up and guests were being signed up and reservations were being made, all of the intentions to have it at the Galt House in Louisville, suddenly, unexpectedly, and devastatingly, the Southern Baptist Convention moved in and scooped up every hotel room in the entire city for the same week. Well, you know, one little pioneer cannot stand against that. And so the date was forfeited, and so was the conference. But the momentum was saved for this year. So if you go to xsquaredradio.com, click on the blue banner, you get $100 off if you click now. And you get to hear anywhere between 20 and 50 of the best speakers in the world, in the Midwest, if you can believe that. Now, there's a lot of things happening in space. We have several stories, and I'm sure some of them you have not heard about because some of them just happened last night. Fortunately, you have me doing the research and keeping up with it so I can bring it to you here. And whether you're listening live or whether you're listening at your workstation while you're working on your favorite project on Monday morning, you will now have the news yourself. I encourage you to join me live. There's going to be some excellent stuff to talk about, especially the recent political race for the Republican nominee. Just super interesting political science. You know, all of the variables, we have the press, we have four dynamic candidates. I would say it's a 1-2-1 formation. You have Ron Paul as a one, you have Rick Santorum as a one, and then you've got Newt Gingrich and Mitt Romney as two. And they're kind of bantering back and forth about the meaning of capitalism and the meaning of conservatism, while the other two are speaking about either national defense or economic prowess. So I think it makes for a really interesting race. I think the longer that these four guys talk about it, the more the conservative point of view is kept in the eye of the press. I don't think people are going to get tired of it. Believe me, the last debate in Charleston was super high ratings, the highest in recent history. And I don't know how many debates we've had. I don't 10, 12, I'm not sure now. It's been so many. People are not losing interest. In fact, people are paying keen attention to what's going on. And if the Facebook and Twitter stuff that I've seen going on in the last couple of weeks is any indication, people realize that this may be the election of our time. Not just a regular election. No, not by any means. We have great ideologies that have reached a point of no return on both sides. And so people are very energetic about it. On the streets, the pontificators behind the scenes, the strategists, and, of course, the candidates themselves, who really have to think on their feet because, you know, those questions are not published in advance. Things that go on in public meetings are quite rough and tumble and quite spontaneous. And so everybody's got to be, you know, briefed on the latest effects of what they're going to say and what they're going to do and how they're going to look and what they're going to wear. Believe me, they go to these debates with several suits and sweaters or whatever they're going to wear. And they check out the lighting and they do surveys. There's all kinds of strategy and science that's going on to affect the future. So I think if you want to discuss that, we can. I'm sure there are some strong feelings out there and those are all welcome here. Now, SpaceX, I'm sure you're familiar with that program, said Tuesday it has postponed its February test flight of the Dragon capsule to the International Space Station, the first ever bid by a private company to dock at the orbiting lab. The delay is due to technical reasons, and a new launch date for the unmanned mission has not been set. The spokesman, Kirsten Grantham, has said in an email to the public, in preparation for the upcoming launch, SpaceX continues to conduct extensive testing and analysis. Translation, we're having technical problems and we may have run out of money. She goes on to say, we believe that there are a few areas that will benefit from additional work and will optimize the safety and success of the mission. We are now working with NASA to establish a new target launch date. SpaceX, by the way, you know, is owned by Elon Musk, who's also the owner of Tesla, the electric car company. He is listed as an internet entrepreneur and founder of PayPal, but his more famous role now is the head of Tesla Automotive. The next steps, a flyby and berthing mission at the International Space Station, were initially scheduled for February 7th, but NASA said in December that date could change because of a significant amount of, quote, critical work that remains before the launch. I think NASA took a look at the space plan and said, have you guys thought about this and that and this and that? No, we haven't. Well, it's back to the drawing board for the SpaceX guys. By the way, if you have been to Morocco lately, yeah, I know I'm saying that kind of tongue-in-cheek because I'm sure none of you have been to Morocco. But anyway, Mars rocks have been falling there for quite some time. I know it sounds fantastic that they would know that the rocks fell from the sky from Mars and landed in Morocco, but they did. They landed in Morocco last summer, and they came from Mars. Scientists have confirmed it. The meteorite chunks, including one that weighed more than 2 pounds, rained down in North Africa last July. A special committee of meteorite experts, including some NASA scientists, studied the rocks and determined their origin. Now, I mean, you're free to call me if you want, 888-429-5471. You know, the last time I checked, Mars is about 44 million miles from Earth. I mean, it's just a little bitty red thing in a retrograde orbit right now that you can see in the early morning sky. It's not in our backyard. You know, it's not local. I mean, yes, it is just the next orbit over. But cosmically speaking, Earth is a pretty tiny target from there. And I have a hard time wondering about how rocks get from the virtually windless deserts of Mars suddenly just pick up off the ground, go flailing out into space, and end up in Morocco. Don't you? I mean, it's only the fifth time in history that experts have been able to confirm by chemical analysis that rocks landing on Earth came from the red planet. Astronomers believe something smashed into Mars millions of years ago and kicked up rock fragments that have been hurtling through the solar system ever since. The landscape in parts of Morocco so resembles that of Mars that rovers destined for the red planet are tested there. Well, don't you think it's strange that Morocco kind of looks like Mars And so therefore Mars rocks fall there? I mean, why not in Burbank? Why not in Paris? No, they got to land on Earth in a place that looks like Mars. It just seems strange to me that rocks would be orbiting around the Earth going, no, no, no. Okay, that looks familiar. We'll fall there. Just interesting stuff, guys. Just interesting stuff. Now, you know, the elections have been taking place. We've had three now so far, one caucus, two primaries. And the interesting thing about these is they're kind of manual right now. They have some electronic voting machines, but they're connected to local precincts. And the local precincts collect and validate that data and make sure that IDs match and make sure that they don't have more votes than they have voters, you know, that kind of stuff, simple stuff. No dead people walking through and voting, nobody coming early and often to vote, that kind of thing. And once that's done, then the numbers are tabulated and you get the results. Well, as you saw in Iowa, it's extremely manual. Each counting place sort of counts it up, puts it on a single sheet of paper. The votes are individual ballots themselves are not kept, but the papers are then turned in, and each precinct, each caucus can tabulate them up. And, you know, the night of the election, it was Mitt Romney by 20 or so. And later, after all the pieces of paper were gathered up and somebody actually added them up and recalculated and revalidated everything, long after the thunder had echoed off into the distance, a new winner was declared, Rick Santorum. So it's just interesting to see how that happens. But as we go forward and the nominee is selected, it gets more and more electronic because the distance for what has to be covered in a short amount of time, it's no longer 50 primaries made up of various caucuses and primary votes where the candidates get to come and make their campaign speeches and meet the public and all of that one state at a time. Now it's all 50 states at one time. So obviously you have to have an electronic way to gather the votes and tabulate them. And it's often been said, not the least of which has been by you as you've emailed me, saying it's not really the voting that counts, it's the counting that counts. Well, a lot of people are looking at this. A lot of important people are looking at this. And a new article has come out. Global voting fraud is being staged. Now, it's not as though voting fraud has taken place in the past, is it? Oh, well, okay, maybe it is. But it's always discovered after the fact. And the trail is sometimes difficult to stir up. You have to go through all kinds of subpoenas, and it's a slow process. And even one state, as you know, recently Indiana was combed for people who had ostensibly been forged. Their identities have been stolen. And the petition signatures that are required to get a candidate on the ballot were validated and found to be false. People's names and addresses and even signatures were put on petitions saying that this candidate or that, in this case it was Obama. And investigators went back and did a fairly large sampling and then a fairly bigger sampling, and they went back and found that many hundreds of people were put down on there, their address, their signature, and it wasn't them. They never filled out that paperwork. Well, it's a little late now, guys. It's about 3 years after the fact, and gee, we found out Obama should never have been on the primary ballot in Indiana. Well, you know, we're already down the road, people, so we can't go back and fix that. Well, now it's being sort of headed off in advance, and what's happened is something that is so blatant, so unbelievably dangerous, that it has made its way into an article in a major step toward global centralization. I'm not talking about national. Global centralization of election processes the world's dominant internet voting company, has purchased the USA's dominant election results reporting company. Now, that sounds like we're definitely going to have ethics at the top of the priority list, doesn't it to you? When you view your local or state election results on the internet, on portals which often appear to be owned by the County Elections Division in over 525 U.S. jurisdictions, you are actually redirected to a private corporate site controlled by SOE Software, which operates under the name ClarityElections.com. That's right. The good news is that this firm promptly reports precinct-level detail in downloadable spreadsheet format, as reported by blackboxvoting.org in 2008. The bad news is that this centralizes one middleman access point for 525 jurisdictions in Alabama, Arizona, California, Colorado, D.C., Florida, Kentucky, Michigan, Kansas, Illinois, Indiana, North Carolina, New Mexico, Minnesota, New York, South Carolina, Texas, Utah, and Washington, and it's growing. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. As local election results funnel through SOE's servers, typically before they reach the public elsewhere, those who run the computer servers for SOE essentially get the first look at results and the ability to immediately and privately examine vote details throughout the United States. In 2004, many Americans were justifiably concerned when, days before the presidential election, Ohio Secretary of State Ken Blackwell redirected Ohio election night results through the Tennessee-based server for several National Republican Party operations. This is worse. This redirects results reporting to a centralized, privately held server, which is not just for Ohio, but national. Not just USA-based, but global. Big difference, folks. All it takes is a little bit of skullduggery behind the screen before you get to see the results, before any election officials get to see the results. Just a little tweak, 0.5% here, 0.5% there, and all the delegates get shifted around. You know how the Electoral College works, don't you? I know. Many of you have written in and said, let's do away with the Electoral College. No, you don't want to do that. Because if you do that and you live in a small state, guess what you don't get? You never get to hear from a presidential candidate again. You never get to hear from a national candidate. Why? Because you don't have enough electoral votes. You don't have enough popular vote to worry about. They go for the states with the large populations because they're going to win by pure popular vote. That means the state's vast number of flyover country will never get to see a national candidate. That's why the Electoral College is important, because every single state has two, and exactly two, senators. That evens the playing field. That makes sure that even New Mexico gets to hear from a presidential candidate. That's right. Even Indiana gets to hear from, even Montana gets to hear from a presidential candidate. That's a big difference. You get to see the ads, you get to hear the platform, and you get to pledge your delegates. Now, that being said, it's done by consensus. Consensus, meaning one over half. 50.0001%, and you get it all. It's winner take all. They don't divide up the delegates. It's not like Florida gives some of their delegates to one candidate and some of their delegates to the other. You get it all. When you win the state, you win all the delegates. And as you saw in the last two elections, actually the last three elections, some of the states came hair-splittingly close to going one way or the other. You remember the hanging chads? You wouldn't even know what a Chad was if it wasn't for the recount in Florida. Come on. Well, if it's handled globally, it ain't going to be handled here. And the audit trail is going to be smoky and murky and handled in the back room, and it will look so legitimate there'll be no questions whatsoever. Do you really want that? Well, that is what we're getting. A mitigation against fraud by SOE insiders has been the separation of voting machine systems from the SOE results reports. Because most U.S. jurisdictions require posting evidence of results from each voting machine at the precinct, public citizens can organize to examine these results to compare with SOE results. Black Box Voting spearheaded a national citizen action to videotape and photograph these poll tapes in 2008. No, it did not violate anonymous voting, because the actual vote from the person being filmed wasn't matched up with the film. What was important was to make sure that you didn't have more votes than you had voters. What you wanted to make sure of is that somebody sliding into Louisville, Kentucky and voting wasn't also sliding into Cincinnati, Ohio, a few miles away, and voting again. We wanted to make sure as best we could that things were validated. You know, somebody that lived in Cincinnati for the first part of the year and registered to vote and then moved to Louisville and then registered to vote again, well, they don't know. They don't cross-check the voter registration cards. They have two voter registration cards on them. So they vote in Kentucky, and then they drive across the border to Ohio, and they vote in Cincinnati. Well, videotaping these things and checking IDs prevents that from happening. Well, with the merger of SOE and SCYTL, that won't work. If SCYTL's voting system is used, that's the global system. When there are two truly independent sources of information, the public can perform its own audit by matching one number against the other. By the way, that's constitutional. All voting records are subject to public audit. It's in the Constitution, in the original one. These two independent sources, however, will now be merged into one single source, a la Fox guarding the henhouse, an internet voting system controlled by SCYTL, with a results reporting system also controlled by, you got it, SCYTL. Can you say lobbyist? With SCYTL, internet voting, there will be no ballots, no physical evidence, no chain of custody, no way for the public to authenticate who actually cast the votes, chain of custody, or the count. There's no way to go back and validate anything. It's like one giant spreadsheet made of anonymous ones and zeros. Just a little too tempting when the world's most powerful job is on the line. SCYTL is moving into or already running elections in the United Kingdom, France, Canada, Norway, Switzerland, United Arab Emirates, South Africa, India, and Australia. And I'm wondering if those 75% sweeps in Egypt aren't also being run that way. SCYTL is based in Barcelona, Spain. Its funding sources come from international venture capital funds, including Nauta Capital, Balterton Capital, and Spinnaker. The way to stop this is clear and simple. It is going to take action and awareness by you. Phone calls and letters and emails by you. Not form letters. Not form letters. Don't do that. Write your own letter. Make your own phone calls. The federal voting system should be the property of the states until the last vote is cast. Only then should the results be sent in to the Federal Voting Commission. And by the way, I would add one more thing. No, it won't make it as interesting on election night to watch the news, but it will make it more legitimate, I think. More what the founding fathers had in mind. You don't remember when time zones were originally come up with, when they originated, where we have Eastern time zone and central time zone and Pacific time zone, right? Well, what happens is the polls close on the East Coast and they immediately begin reporting. And of course, the press taps into that. And as the Florida results come in and the New York results come in and the North Carolina results come in, they're announced on national news. And so those that are just getting off work in L.A. can see the results from Florida, North Carolina, New York, Massachusetts, etc. Oh, well, my candidate's not doing so well, so I'm going to vote for the other guy because I don't want to vote for a loser. I mean, why? Come on. I mean, let's... They are influenced by the results is what I'm trying to say. If the federal voting results are the property of the states until the last vote is cast, they should be the property of the states until the last vote is cast in the country. When the polls close on the last precinct in the last time zone of the U.S., then and only then should the states release their results to the Federal Voting Commission. Not voting results should be, the voting results should not be released until the last precinct closes in the last time zone. This would stop Eastern state misreporting from influencing the states in the West. I can't tell you how many elections have been called before the last vote was counted. Yeah, it has happened several times. In fact, newspapers have been printed with the winner and hit the stands. But the election didn't come out that way. Once all the votes were actually counted, that newspaper did not influence the outcome. Just interesting stuff that you should be aware of in this election season. You didn't know all that stuff was going on until you listened to this program, but now you know. So let's have a quick break, and we'll be back right after this. Don't go away.
Saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archer split the tree.
There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century.
Well, I was lying in a burned out basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky.
There was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie.
Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship flying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one.
All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun.
Welcome back to the second hour of X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location in North Carolina.
The spice extends life. The spice expands consciousness. The spice is vital to space travel.
It is a wonderful thing to be able to have webcast radio here on BBS Radio Network. And this is the number one network on the web, and X Squared Radio is the number one program on the number one network. So you're at the right place. Listeners all over the world. By the way, as you are planning your adventures for the year 2012, there's one that I don't want you to miss. We call it Maya 2012. The place, Chichen Itza in the Yucatan, ground zero for everything 2012. You know what's going to happen there. One of the most exciting conferences, well, in a thousand years, what can I say? Chichen Itza, Maya 2012. Myself, Greg Braden, others will be there speaking at the ground zero of everything mystical about the year 2012. Also, in the same venue will be Sting and Carlos Santana. We're going to head down on the 13th of December, be back on the 22nd. I will have you home for Christmas, I promise. This is a very unique year, so don't sit around the mall shopping. Do something amazing. Click on the orange banner that says Maya 2012 at xsquaredradio.com and join me at the top of the world, Chichen Itza, in the jungles of the Yucatan. I promise you will come away changed. And when your grandkids ask you, where did you spend December 21st, 2012, you can tell them, I was with the Maya at Chichen Itza. Once in a lifetime, once in a millennia chance to be there. Join us tonight by calling toll-free 888-429-5471 anywhere in North America. Lots of controversy in the press today and actually this week. Very, very cool debates going on, those of you that are following the issues. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can reach us at 530-413-6472. From time to time, we talk about natural resources and energy. And one of the things I want to bring to your attention is oil. And we talk about it from, you know, all kinds of standpoints, from peak oil to the jockeying back and forth between the oil-based, petroleum-based economy, which is a very old hunter-gatherer mentality. They have great tools for drilling in the ground and great weapons for finding and securing the place in the ground to make those holes. And, of course, oil is a pretty cheap, almost free energy in the sense that you and five of your friends can make your way up the road for a couple of miles for about 20 cents. That doesn't sound like that big of a deal, but I guarantee that if you go to Shanghai and you find yourself a rickshaw driver, somebody that will pedal you or pull you, and you say, I want you to take me and five of my friends a couple miles up the road for 20 cents, they're going to laugh at you. Human power is expensive. Petroleum is so cheap that it has made huge amounts of effects all over the planet. However, as you know, some people have it and some people don't. Those that have it are sitting back and counting the cash, and those that don't have to figure out how they're going to budget it into their energy profiles. For the United States, the energy usage in the form of petroleum has been pretty flat. It will be for the next 20 years. Trust me, the Department of Transportation does these estimates based on the number of vehicles that are on the road, the number of miles of highway that we have, the number of licensed drivers that we have, and they've figured it out. And, of course, the game changer is that the efficiency of the automobiles continues to improve. And as your old 1965 Mustang falls apart and joins the rest of the junk in the junkyard, and you replace it with a 1995 Mustang, you find that the car that originally got 10 miles or 12 miles to the gallon now gets about 36 miles to the gallon. It's a big difference, and things are getting more and more efficient with fuel injection and computer-controlled throttles so that you really can't light up the tires like they show you on television. So the amount of usage of petroleum gets kind of flat, but the production of petroleum is quite a different thing. The last really big oil discovery was in 1972. And there have been a couple, but not as really easy to refine and easy to drill like Saudi oil or Texas oil. Those fields are playing out one after the other. The Saudis are drilling constantly every single day. Texas, there's only one thing more plentiful than oil fields in Texas, and that's old pumped out oil fields in Texas. Same thing in California, same thing in Tennessee and Kentucky, same thing in Pennsylvania. It plays out. We've punched deep water holes in the Gulf of Mexico, hoping to find the mother lode. It's risky. It's dangerous. It puts Mother Nature at risk. It puts the workers at risk. Many lives have been lost hunting and gathering the oil reserves deep in the earth. Recently in North Dakota, another, it's kind of controversial as to what the reserve is. Some say it's about 4 to 5 billion barrels. Of course, the president of the oil company is saying it's more like 24 billion barrels. And if so, this is liquid petroleum. Now, these aren't tar sands. This is drill into the ground and start pumping it out. However, the EPA and the White House is putting quite a damper on that, and it's quite an arm wrestling match between government and the oil companies, but that's what you have. Now, places where you would think that it's plentiful, it's cheap. Believe me, you can buy gasoline in Egypt for about 25 cents a gallon. In Saudi Arabia, I think it's still 12 cents a gallon. It's really amazing. But right now, there's an oil shortage in Egypt. Yeah, in Egypt. Fuel shortages and rumors of price hikes created havoc in the Egyptian capital for the third straight day of Tuesday of last week as motorists rushed to fill up their tanks despite official assurances. The oil ministry, yes, they have an oil ministry in Egypt, just like they have an antiquities ministry. The oil ministry, led, of course, by a minister, said on Monday authorities were pumping 21.5 million liters of fuel daily, with 9 million liters associated for the Cairo government alone, denying any plans to raise the cost of fuel, which is, of course, subsidized, just like it is in this country. But these assurances failed to calm motorists. Imagine that. You remember when we had rationing lines, when you had an odd or even Social Security number or odd or even license plate number, and you could come on a Tuesday or a Wednesday to get your fuel, but when it ran out, it ran out. It was rationed. You could get 10 gallons or 20 gallons, and that was about it. Well, taxi driver Mohammed Hussein, that's about as common as Bob Smith in this country, Mohammed Hussein said he crisscrossed the Egyptian capital on Tuesday in search of fuel. I drove to more than 10 fuel stations, but they all had signs saying out of fuel. Before finding one where I could fill up the tank, said Hussein, he nevertheless had to wait 1 hour in a long line before being serviced at a station in southern Cairo. By the way, if you've ever been to Cairo, it's don't try renting a car and driving in Cairo. There are no traffic lights in a city of 20 million people. You will wear out your horn button, and then you'll have to buy an external horn button and mount it somewhere on your steering column, because the horn is kind of used like turn signals are in this country. A certain number of honks say that you're getting ready to pass somebody, and they're supposed to yield to you, especially if you're honking rather rapidly like a panicked New Yorker. That's why it's so noisy to hear traffic in Cairo. Authorities are blaming speculators and smugglers for the crisis, a likely story. The official Planning International Cooperation Minister, Faiza Abdul Naga, said, "What we are witnessing is an artificial crisis caused by rumors by some people who have interest in making profit. You gotta be kidding me. Like that ever happens." The point is that there isn't enough supply to go around. It isn't that the price was going up. It's that the supply was going down. Well, if that's happening in Egypt, just a couple hundred miles away from the source, imagine what it will be like in places that the stuff has to get on a boat and get there. It's quite a struggle. And one of the things that's interesting about oil is that although green technologies, be it solar, be it wind, be it electric vehicles or hybrids, although they are making only a fingernail scratch on the market, it seems as though the petroleum industry spends a significant amount of its lobbying dollars and its marketing dollars to make sure that those technologies don't get a foothold. I know it seems kind of silly, but have you heard the press lately on the Volt? Now, I'm not talking about talking to Volt drivers. Chevy Volt drivers are wonderful. I mean, they swear by the car. Yeah, it was expensive. $50,000 is a lot for a small sedan, just because it has a few batteries under the floorboard. But they like the car. It drives well. It's quiet. They, you know, almost feel it a challenge to see how far they can go before that gasoline motor turns on. They try to accelerate slowly, and they make less of a draw. They can see the gauges, and they just try to make sure the battery lasts as long as it can. And some people are getting 40 miles, maybe a little further than 40 miles, and most people, 90% of the people, don't drive 40 miles in a day, so they can get that little thing all the way back home and plug it in again and without ever using the fuel. So it's kind of neat. It's kind of a neat challenge. Well, that's if you talk to the owners. But if you listen to the business programs like Fox News Business or CNN or MSNBC or ABC or CBS or NBC, you hear quite an opposite story. To them, to the business analysts, the Volt is a complete disaster. That it costs something like, I don't know, $250,000 a car, and that, you know, they're sitting around showrooms and parking lots everywhere and they're not selling, and the Volt never did, you know, catch spark. And the whole green idea, solar and wind and all that, it's just a big scam and it'll never work. It will never work. Come on, how many times have you heard that? I'm sure you have. 888-429-5471, we can talk about it. It's a huge controversy. Because in the real world, when a person puts solar panels on their home, yes, it costs about $16,000 or $18,000 to put a nice set of solar panels on a house. But then your light bill goes down to $2. Forever, well, for the next 20 years, that is, I think that's a good savings, because somewhere in that 20 years, life is going to get unpredictable for you. Either the power grid's going to go down, or you're going to lose your job, or you want to take a sabbatical for a couple of years. Well, that $200 or $300 that you normally spend on that light bill, it isn't there. You know, you're going to get electricity for $10 a month, whatever it costs you to hook up to the meter, whatever their minimum, you know, fee is. But hang on a second. Why? Right. My. Okay. We got her. All right. That's good. That's good. All right. So we have Sandra Sabatini. Just give me a second to close out this subject. And to hear the negative press about that is just unbelievable to me. You know, a solar panel will last in direct sunlight for about 20 years before the silicon begins to give out and the panel itself has to be replaced. But that's not the most expensive part. The expensive part is all the circuitry that has to go in and the inverter that has to go in and the storage system that has to go in and the regulator so that you don't overpower your house and you have the right voltage to be able to run all your good stuff in your house. All that's the expensive part. Once the solar panel's in, then your overhead drops to nothing. And, you know, pretty much the same thing with wind generators. As long as you don't spin it too fast, then the transmission will last a long time. And there are all kinds of variable transmissions being designed right now. And it allows you to sort of get off-grid. And it's the same thing with electric vehicles. Batteries are now lasting 7 or 8 years before they have to be replaced. And technology is out there. It's not in production yet, but the technology is out there where the batteries will last 20 or 25 years. That's a long time. If you can keep from crashing your car and keep the regular maintenance up, brakes and, you know, windshield wiper blades and windshield wiper motors and stuff like that, if you can keep that up, then you've got a vehicle for life. You don't have to put fuel in it, and that means a lot. Especially with the ups and downs of employment and credit and interest and all kinds of world events that can affect the availability of energy. Especially if you've got solar panels on your house or on your car where you can charge the beggar up in the sun. That changes the whole game. Even if every electric vehicle company in the country went into full production tomorrow, we still would not be able to scratch the motor vehicle market for at least 20 years. So why the bad press? That's a good question. I don't really know. I appeal to you to try to figure that out. Why would the hunter-gatherer community of the petroleum cartels around the world want to keep you from driving your electric vehicle? Doesn't make much sense, does it? Even if we had a million of them on the road, it would barely scratch the surface, except for those who are driving them. For those who are driving them, it makes a big difference. Trust me, I know the difference between buying diesel every week and not buying diesel every week. It makes a big difference. Now, my good friend Sandra Sabatini is the pioneer. And by pioneer, I mean the kind of pioneer that trudges out into the frontier. Past the area where there's the last minute mark where you can get stuff. Way out there where you got to carry your own supplies. You got to pull yourself up by your bootstraps every single day. You got to weather everything yourself. That kind of pioneer. Sandra Sabatini is putting together a huge conference called the Pythagoras Conference in the Midwest. It might as well be on the moon. People, except that it's in the middle of 73% of the population of the United States. So millions and millions of people who never got to hear any of this. This stuff doesn't get on History Channel. It doesn't get on Discovery Channel. You don't see this. This is the leading edge of the leading edge of the best minds on the planet. Books and films and lectures and great minds from all around the world are going to be there. At the Pythagoras Conference, and we're lucky enough right now to have the pioneer that has the backpack carrying the whole conference on her shoulders. Welcome to the program, Sandra. How are you?
I'm doing very well, Brooks. Thanks for having me tonight.
Well, it's my pleasure. You know, when we're putting together something like this, we look at people who have been well, I was going to use the word successful. I'll say it another way. We look at people who have tried it before. We look at Conscious Life Expo, or we look at the UFO Retrieval Expo in Las Vegas. Those people have been at it for years, and they've had great backers behind them. And, of course, they've lost a few shirts and a few pairs of shoes over it to get it up and off the ground. Now those areas are kind of a mecca. Once a year, you have the regulars, you know, that need one form of therapy or another showing up at those things. But in the Midwest, it's pretty vacuous. There is no good word. So what inspired you? What got you started on the idea of bringing it to the Louisville area?
Well, first, Brooks, it's my hometown. Louisville, Kentucky is my hometown. I was born there. You know, that's where I have my roots, is there in Kentucky. And this conference started as a dream of bringing the best minds together in one place for 5 days to put aside all political differences and to really give back to humanity for 5 days from 6 a.m. in the morning to 11 p.m. at night, continuous lectures to really give back. And it's been tremendous. We've had tremendous support from a lot of people around the world. We're going to have 12 people, 12 different countries there represented at the conference itself. We'll have over 20 to 50 speakers, as you know. It's going to be huge, Brooks.
And what's the venue now? It was going to be the Galt House, I remember, before the Southern Baptist Convention moved in with their you know, tight-fitting suits and polished shoes and Cadillacs and said, no. Every hotel room in the city belongs to us. So I know that was going to be 11-11-11 last year.
Right.
And there were a lot of 11-11-11 conferences around the country. And, bless their hearts, I think they all did good. But you kept your momentum and your focus, and you didn't let them beat you. So now where is it going to be?
We sure did. It's going to be at the Caesars Horseshoe Casino in Elizabeth, Indiana, right across the river from Louisville, Kentucky. So it's right there, centrally located. It's a fabulous facility. It's larger. And we're going to do probably about 1,500 people there this year, Brooks.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that will be fantastic. You know, I'm not familiar with the area because I don't frequent casinos. I have out west because it's just a great place for meeting, and there's various conventions and things like that out there. But this is a really top-quality facility in southern Indiana, right?
Exactly. As you know, Harrah's Casino, they're an international casino chain. I mean, this is a top-notch facility, and they are our partners in this. So that right there is a big thing, as far as I know, in our industry, that we do have their backing for this conference. They are sponsors of this conference, and we have their full support.
Wow, that's great. I have been to conferences where we stayed in tents in the weeds. I've been to conferences that were breakout rooms of hotels. I've been to conferences that were in theaters of universities. Mm-hmm. But something that is, you know, has all of these features. And the best thing about it, Sandra, is I don't have to fly to get there.
That's true. You're right there in the backyard, so to speak. But I'll tell you, you know, we have a lot of people, like I said, coming in from all over the world, coming, you know, flying right there into Louisville International Airport. As you know, we have Princess Nakamaru from Japan who's going to be there. You know, yourself, you're going to be doing the keynote there, and I thank you so much, Brooks, for you doing that. And we're going to have Dr. David Anderson, who's going to be talking about time control science there. Oh, gosh, we have people coming in from Romania, like Dr. Florin Montagnu, who's going to be talking about complexity sciences and fractals. And, oh, my goodness, and our good friend, Dr. Edward Close, is going to be there talking about transcendental physics and just so many brilliant minds in one place. We invite everyone to come down to Elizabeth, Indiana for this outstanding event.
You know, I've had lengthy conversations with several of your exhibitors, several of your speakers, and I got to tell you that the original thought process, like Dr. Ed Close and Michael Cremo and others, the original thought process, the pioneering work that they have done in their specific areas, it really changed the world. I mean, we originally thought that we, crawled forth from some primordial ooze and that we, you know, mutated over time in some Darwinian slurry that, we ended up to be the I was going to say intelligent beings that we are, although sometimes I have my doubts. But when Michael Cremo came on the scene and he began consolidating, collecting, and documenting evidence that intelligent, not just modern man, but intelligent man has not existed for thousands of years or even tens of thousands of years, but millions of years on this planet, really opened the world. And he's been all over the world, not just speaking to non-affiliated sources. He's been speaking at major universities all over the world for years. And he is changing the science. And that's the kind, that's the quality of researcher that you're bringing to this conference.
Well, I tell you, we have people like Klaus Dana that's going to be speaking about some of his latest discoveries. As you know, that him and Michael Tellinger have just been on this great expedition, and they got some tremendous research. So he's going to be there with us also via live virtual remote. Also have to make a correction, too, to let our listeners know that Dr. David Louis Anderson is going to be doing a live SATCOM for that 3 days. So he will be there live in person.
Wow, that's
and,
great.
And we got Clifford Mahudi from the Zuni Nation, who's going to be coming there and speaking about, you know, the changes that we're going through as a society and about the focusing on our youth. You know, that's some of the things that, you know, you go to a lot of these conferences and you go in there and you take in all this information. But afterwards, you're just like, okay, well, what do I do with it? Well, the difference between Pythagoras Conference and some of the other conferences out there, not only are we going to open up this dialogue with all these brilliant minds, we're going to talk about developing solutions. We're going to start giving people some tools. And we're going to challenge people to go out there and make a change in our world. Because we really do believe that each one of us can make a change. And that's why our conference is so different, is that our conference is creating this tremendous momentum for change. It truly is. And out of this conference is the development of a think tank, essentially, to create this educational initiative for youth. So you're going to see that develop out of this conference.
Awesome. Now, why Pythagoras? What is the significance of this ancient philosopher?
Well, you know Pythagoras. Well, some people know that Pythagoras was, you know, a great, you know, mystic scientist, great mathematician. But, you know, he was also a great seeker of knowledge. And that, to me, Brooks, is the undercurrent of this conference, is, you know, bringing the best minds together, the best speakers together in their fields to share their knowledge with people, just like, you know, all those people out there that want answers. They want the truth. And that's what we're going to do. That 5 days, we're going to bring the public the truth for the very first time. Some of the technologies that you're going to see at this conference have been sequestered for over 50-something years. And we're going to show this at this conference. And we're going to let humanity decide what they're going to do with that knowledge.
Now,
we're
of
really
course,
going to bring it.
What we want you to do, listeners, is we want you to go to xsquaredradio.com or phoenixsciencefoundation.org, and we want you to click on the Pythagoras Conference banner. When you do that, what specials do you have for them now if they click on that banner?
For your listeners, if they go over there tonight, after they finish listening to this broadcast, if they click on your banner and they enter in Brooks or B. Agnew, that's capital B, capital A, B. Agnew, 2012, we'll give them $100 off their 5-day admission ticket. That's exclusively for your listeners tonight.
That is pretty amazing. Make sure to click on the banner. Now, a lot of people are listening live. They sit out there and don't ask questions by the thousands. But many more, as is evidenced by the bandwidth that I have to buy each month, they listen to the archive when they go into work on Monday morning. They just click on X Squared Radio. They put on their headset. They work on, you know, blueprints and spreadsheets and word processing, and they listen to the program. So if you're listening tomorrow, you should still be able to click on that banner and get this great discount. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the struggle, because this is a great human interest story. We've got about 30 minutes left in this hour, and I want to cover it, because it's the great entrepreneurial spirit of this country, and we're talking a lot about that right now from a variety of viewpoints. A lot of people call it jobs, they call it job creation, but it's really the entrepreneurial spirit. It's the spirit of America to be able to come to this country, whether you're born here or whether you're an immigrant here, and to work hard and to have a vision, to have something that you believe in so strongly that it wakes you up in the middle of the night. It bugs you every single day, and every single day you move it sometimes infinitesimally forward, sometimes two steps forward and one step back, and sometimes you're just not clean down the steps, but you keep getting back up. So tell me what it is that inspired you to do this and what keeps you going to make this happen. Because I think, I know my listeners are particularly interested in, you know, not the people that complain all the time, I can't get this done, I can't get that done, but the people who get knocked off the horse and get back on the horse and keep it going forward. That's the spirit of what drives this country. Tell us about that struggle.
Well, I'll tell you, it's putting something together like this is not an easy task, as you know. It's, you know, there's a lot of challenge there. You have a lot of people from various different backgrounds coming together for a common goal. And truly, the whole purpose of this and the whole purpose of this event for us was to give back to humanity. And what drives me, what inspires me, is to bring the truth forward. Because we all want to know the truth. And that's what keeps me going, Brooks.
Truth is truth. But, that learning about what everybody knows about is truth and what we suspect. Or, you know, when we put all the pieces together, sometimes we have big gaps between what we know to be true and what's really happening out there. And the interesting thing about that is that the gaps sometimes are filled in by prognosticators, by pastors, by news organizations, and even worse, by universities, who will say things like, well, that's just a mystery, and or that's just the way things are. This is the way planets form. This is where man came from. This is what gravity is. This is where energy comes from. And no, there's no mysterious source of energy. And yet you have all these great thinkers out there who never get a chance to tell their story. And it's the truth in between the truth, the pieces that really inspire those that are wondering what there is out there that makes it special. Why are we here? What are we doing here? What is it that we feel between our relationship of the body, the spirit, and even this planet? And that is what these great thinkers have explored into, and they're always looking for a place to tell their story, but we never get to hear that in the Midwest.
Indeed, and that's the reason why this conference is happening. You know, you can have a conference like this on the East Coast, you can have it on the West Coast, but it was really important for me to have this in the heartland, you know, right there in the heart. And that's one of the other reasons that we're bringing this conference to Kentucky, because there is that void there, as you're talking about, of having this kind of knowledge in that area. And that's what we're doing. You know, we're really bringing it forward to Kentucky. We're going to be doing it every year in Kentucky. We're actually going to be expanding this out into a global initiative. You'll see that Pythagoras will be growing into Egypt in 2013. But we'll have an international outreach over there. And we're going to be expanding into Romania in probably 2014. So we got a lot going on, and I invite all of your listeners who have a really deep interest in this conference to go to the website look at the website, read through the website, and get plugged in to this tremendous initiative, because we really are bringing four truths that really haven't been discussed in public before. These people that are there at this conference are not really on the lecture speaker circuit. These are scientists. Scientists that are very reclusive that are going to be there. So we've got something very special at this conference, and we invite all your listeners to come and see what makes us so different.
Well, you've done a great job. If you can get those kinds of thinkers, those people that, you know, we would read about their works 20 or 50 years from now and wonder about, you know, how they came up with their ideas, what was their original aha moment that caused them to put it together. But we're going to get to hear them live, and that makes a big difference. And then the nice thing about it, I think, and not to be one long infomercial, but the nice thing about it is I'm a 2 or 3 hour drive away. As you know, 73% of the country's population is an 8 hour drive from Louisville. And it has been steadily moving west. I think it was somewhere in Ohio or east of Ohio 75 years ago. And it's been steadily moving west as we, distribute energy and power and roads to flyover country. More and more cities are beginning to grow. And now, I mean, gosh, you're not far from Chicago. You're not far from Atlanta. You're definitely not far from St. Louis. Of course, you got Indianapolis a few minutes away. So this is a chance for literally tens of millions of people who are wondering about the purpose of life, who are wondering about the mystery of what's going on with 2012, what's going on as our solar system is getting closer to the galactic plane. We hear a little bit about it on History Channel or Discovery Channel, but it's all animated. There's no real explorers. There's no real work being done. This is the leading edge of the leading edge, people. This is where it's going to happen. And you could be there. By the way, I just want to let you know that the New York Giants pulled ahead 17-14 in the fourth quarter. It is a whale of a struggle between the 49ers and the Giants, just so you know. The great American struggle happens on the football field, not. So, Sandra, let's talk a little bit about how this plays into, because I think it's particularly inspiring, poignant, if you will, what's happening on the political front. And I don't mean the political front with all the ads and blah, 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 and all that. I'm talking about the energy of where people see themselves involved with their country. We have people hitting the sidewalks and parks in just about every major city in the country. Mm-hmm. And they don't really have a focus. They're just kind of anti. They're just kind of anti. But they sense that something has gone wrong. We have the Tea Party, which is sort of the middle-aged people that are maybe more politically experienced. And they realize that this is not the liberty that we grew up with. And does that mean that we're modernizing? No. Does it mean that we need to have bigger government taking care of us from the day we put our first footprint on paper to the day we breathe our last breath? No. What we're seeing is across the board in all walks of life, we are seeing an allergic reaction of the people to the regimentation and the control of the tribal world. It is something that we are rejecting because something is not resonating with the spirit within. And it goes along with this conference because this is a desire. You know, it doesn't matter where I go, Sandra. If I go into factories, you know, I'm a contract engineer, and I go into factories and help them become more efficient. All kinds of businesses get off on sidetracks. They hit plateaus, and they don't know how to improve. They don't know how to get their profits back. They don't know how to get their contracts back. I go in and I talk to them. it never fails. Within a very short amount of time, somehow, I have no idea how this happens, but somehow the conversation comes around to something they saw on the National Geographic Channel, or something they heard on the news about space travel, or oil scarcity, or some anthropological struggle that's going on in the world today. One government after another after another after another is falling to the will of the people, and they're fascinated by it. So there is a heartbeat going on in the people that is different. It's dissident to what is going on in our, and I'm just going to use the word, society. So what are you feeling about that?
Oh, gosh, Brooks, what a question. I feel just like everyone else does. You know, we want change. There is a, what I call, not an awakening, but a remembering of who we are, who humanity is. And we're just tired, we're sick and we're tired of the status quo. And we all want that change. We all have within us, as you know, Brooks, we all know what the truth is. You know, we all know what the truth is when we hear it. We can feel it in our hearts. And I think that there's just this pace right now of people just sick and tired of being sick and tired. They want change. You mentioned the bankers. You mentioned the banking system. Look at the tremendous, you know, initiative that's going on, that has been going across America and around the world this just past year. If people want freedom, they want change. And this is all coming from their hearts. You know, I was having a discussion with one of the speakers just the other day, and I said, you know, if we could all just think with our hearts how that this change could happen around the world in an instant, if just 10% of our population really just started focusing on their heart and what they really want, we could change, we could revolutionize the world. You know, we really need to claim our voices again. We really need to stand up for ourselves, not, you know, just for this generation, but all future generations to come. And kind of going back to the Pythagoras conference, that's what we're doing. We're creating these dialogues. Everyone there is there because they're coming there from their hearts. You know, everyone is there because they want to give back. And, you know, we're living in a tremendous time of change. And it is truly a great remembering for humanity.
You know, you said that people know what they want. I definitely find that people know what they don't want.
That's true, too.
Few people really know what they want. They kind of know the direction they want to go in. But, you know, I wrote the book Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel. And in that book, I really take a couple of chapters to teach people how to dream. It sounds kind of basic, kind of rudimentary, but you'd be surprised how many people dream about the wrong stuff. They focus on the wrong thing. And guess what they get? The wrong thing, because they're focusing on it. But they do know what they don't want. And I have a strong feeling that people don't want to be taken care of. They don't want to be given food stamps. They want to be given the opportunity to get a job. They don't want to work flipping burgers or work waiting tables if they have a degree in architecture. They don't want to be mowing grass or painting houses or fixing cars in their own garage at home, you know, when they have a degree in economics. They want the opportunity to dream again. And I think that's what's missing. When I talk to people in the Occupy Party, whether it's on the street corner or whether it's at a restaurant, and the other day we had such a, well, I wasn't gonna say heated, but it wasn't heated. And I had aroused their faculties. I'll put it that way. And the faculties got so loud that the restaurant asked us to leave. It wasn't that we were arguing. It's that, you know, I was asking questions, and it just happened to be something that excited the passion in these Occuparty people. And they made their point with a lot of energy. And people that were trying to enjoy their chicken wings with a little less bravado wanted us to leave. So we did. But the energy of what these people want, or what they don't want, I was going to say, is really powerful. And it's a little misdirected, I think, in some cases, because they use the word like, you know, one of them said, anybody making over $100 million a year ought to be put in jail. Well, I'm sorry, that's not the way the free enterprise system works. I mean, if I am a manager or a broker and I bring $100 billion deal to the table, my commission's probably going to be somewhere around $100 million. I deserve it, because you only do that once in a lifetime, unless you're, you know, Warren Buffett or you're Donald Trump. You just only do a deal like that once in a lifetime. For the energy that was being projected was that they have and I don't. And I just don't want them to have if I can't have. Mm. And that's what I, you know, if you get a chance to go out of the country, and you have too, if you go to Egypt now, you're going to be mobbed, because the tourist business is down by 90%, and that's their livelihood. So if you show up as an American in your Nikes and your Levi's, you're going to be asked for every dime that you have, because you have and they don't. And that's the energy of what I feel from the Occuparty. Those that are successful and have made a success or have success on their doorstep have, and they don't. And that's where the energy comes from. So what I see a great conference like this accomplishing is it puts the spirit of the dream or the ability to dream directly in their hands. And they can do great things with it, because there's no limit to what they can dream. Isn't that the point?
Absolutely, Brooks. Absolutely. It's the passion. It's the passion. It's the dream. And, you know, another point is that, you know, if you went back 50 years, 60 years, 70 years, and said, you know, look, you know, we were going to send someone to the moon, they would have said you were crazy. You know, all these things that's happened in our society, everything that we have was once a dream, was a part of imagination before it became reality. And each one of us has that potential, that hidden potential to create that kind of change, to bring, to manifest these things forward. You know, I truly believe that with everything in my being, that we can create this new reality. We can create this new change. We can create the society that we all want, that we all deserve. And, you know, this conference, it's kind of hard to kind of encapsulate truly everything that this conference is. But what I would say is, come to the conference and see and feel the change, because there's going to be tremendous change created there.
I like that. I like that. That should be the slogan of the conference. Feel the change. You know, you mentioned something, if you go back 50 years, I just did. And remember I had in my hands a 1955 newspaper. Hmm. And in the newspaper, there was an article that said that the Congress was voting to close the U.S. Patent Office, because everything that could be invented had been invented. And so you look at today and, well, you go back to 1955 and then you look at today and you go, wow, those people, I'm surprised they could rub two sticks together to make fire. I mean, they were just primitive. Here we are today. We could, if we wanted to, if we could focus on something besides breaking things and killing people, we could be traveling between planets right now. We could be concentrating on eliminating the ignorance that causes hunger in the world. Mm-hmm. And notice I didn't say taking care of the hungry. Because if we ship rice and beans everywhere in the world and we give it to people who don't know how to provide for themselves, then you're going to have to give even more the next year and more the next year, because that's the nature of that equation. But if you teach people that the balance of what they do in their society is based upon their ability to produce, you teach them to read, you teach them to cultivate the soil, you teach them to filter their water and keep their waterways clean and clear, teach them to read, teach them to work within the limits of their environment. Now you have saved the world, because there is no need to go pouring over the border into your neighbor's bounty and take from him, because you can make everything you need and you can trade between one another peacefully. There's no reason to go out and conquer one another. You know, that's one of the things that is in the news, and particularly in political limelight right now, is this thing they call national defense. I think it's more appropriately called national offense, because if you've traveled the world, been out there, China and Japan, Korea, Spain, Mexico, Canada, what you see is national offense. You don't really see national defense. You know, our military has become the pawns of, I want to call it nation building, but there's got to be better words for it than that. And our local police have gone from being Andy of Mayberry to being, you know, paramilitary in black uniforms with black glasses and hard batons and tasers and pepper spray. I wouldn't go to a cop for help, would you?
Times are changing.
Yeah, but they're moving in the wrong direction. This is the allergic reaction that people are having. This is why there's a spiritual renaissance going on in our world today. This is why a conference like this is going to be so wildly popular, because millions of people know, they remember, something is not right. We're marching down a road to militant, I don't know, martial law, that we should not be going down. We are an enlightened, intelligent, free people. And we're acting like, you know, for lack of a better word, we're acting like the lines being marched into concentration camps.
We forgot our own power, Brooks. Humanity has kind of forgotten their own power. We give our will so freely to those who are in control. And it's time to remember.
They're right. We abdicate the responsibility for the care and feeding of our own biological transducer. That's our bodies, for those that don't listen to this program regularly. We abdicate the responsibility of the care and feeding of that to someone else. Mm-hmm. How silly. Well, I am, for one, am proud of you. I think you're doing a heck of a job. And here's the thing about it, listeners, Earth explorers everywhere. Of the tens of thousands of people that listen to this program on a weekly basis, and it changes around because I see the bandwidth, how much we're flowing, somewhere around 2 terabytes a month, which is a lot of data going out there, a lot of people listening to this content. The bottom line is that you have friends. You have acquaintances. You have people that you work with. You have people that you live next to. You have people that babysit your kids. You have people that you're in class with. I want you to talk to them about the Pythagoras Conference. I want you to get together with them, and let's make this conference 1,500 to 2,000 people strong. Why? Yeah, it would be nice to have the revenue so that we can do it again in 2013. But it would be even nicer if you had the experience of going there so that you can remember what it is you came here to do. Is that a good thought, Sandra?
Indeed, Brooks. Indeed. Indeed. Indeed.
So that's what it's all about. Remember, talk to your friends. We're not talking about a whole lot of money here. We're talking about the price of a cup of coffee a day for you to get ready for this conference. When is it?
It is October 10th through the 14th. October 10th through the 14th, go to www.pythagorasconference.com. And you do have a banner there on your website, right, Brooks?
I do. And the thing about it is, this is a long way from Valentine's Day. It's a long way from Christmas. It's nowhere close to Thanksgiving. In fact, I can't think of anything except for maybe Halloween that's even remotely close to it. So there's no competition for this time slot. Get it done. See yourself there. All right, Sandra. News that we should know about? What are any breakthroughs recently relative to the conference that'll inspire people to get on the bandwagon here?
Well, I'll tell you, we're bringing, like I said, Princess Kaoru Nakamaru from Japan. She's going to be there live and in person to give a lecture. And from what we understand, this is a very rare occasion. And we're very, very happy to have her there with us. We've got tremendous news coming very, very soon. We ask everyone to stay tuned to PythagorasConference.com for the latest details. And Brooks, I want to thank you personally for your tremendous support and encouragement for this wonderful global event that we're putting together for all of humanity, because we are all there to truly, truly give back to humanity from our hearts. And we invite everyone that can hear this message tonight to come. Because for those who have questions, we do have answers. We do have answers.
We occasionally stretch out to the year 2015. And you remembering the future, the physics of the soul and time travel was written in the year 2015. It was only brought back to the year 2009 and actually launched as a book. Because in 2015, the path that we were going by, everything is messed up. I mean, the presidency is messed up. We don't make it, okay? We're on a path to anthropological cataclysm in 2015. So the book comes back to the year 2009 to provide people with the tools that they need to change the slope of humanity, change the path, because we were marching inexorably down a path that the prophets laid out for us. Does that mean the prophets are wrong? No, it doesn't. We're empowered by the prophets. The prophets are telling us this is what's going to happen if you don't change. If you keep going the way that you're going, this is what's going to happen. No prophet ever told us this is where you're going to be and you have no choice in the matter. Well, there are a few events that are key juxtapositions for where great thoughts meet great people and have great effects. They're noticeable. They're turning points in a society. One of them is the Pythagoras Conference. You have to be there if you're going to have your effect on the future and move us away from the wasteland that is 2015. Got it? All right, Sandra, is there anything else?
Just I wanted to thank you, Brooks, once again, and to all your listeners out there, thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much for your support. And just remember, the future is listening.
Ooh, I like it. The future is listening. You got that? All right. Thank you so much. Oh, I was going to ask you, do you have a newsletter that people can sign up for? It's
sure,
free, keep them informed. How do they do that?
Absolutely. If you go over to Facebook, to go to www.facebook.com/Pythagoras Conference, we have a online newsletter right there that anyone can sign up for and get plugged in today.
There you have it. I mean, how much more connected can you be? Be a Facebook friend. Get on the Pythagoras Conference newsletter, facebook.com/Pythagoras Conference. If you don't know how to spell it, go to X Squared Radio and look at the banner. It's right there, PYTH, blah, 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 and get signed up. It's free. It'll keep you informed. It'll keep you with the latest news. You'll know who's coming up. And by all means, you don't have to go there and pay for the whole thing. Go there, get your deposit in. See yourself there. Make your commitment. Sandra, thank you so much for coming on X Squared Radio tonight.
Thank you, sir. It's been a pleasure.
All right. We'll talk to you another time.
All right, sir. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Okay, we'll take a quick break, a little civil twilight. We'll do Letters from the Sky. You should listen to the words of this song. Really cool song. And by the way, it was in the final scene and credits from the movie I Am Number 4. We'll see you in about 4 minutes. Welcome back to X Squared Radio, third hour, January 22nd, 2012. Oh, the year is clicking away day by day. Great things are happening. It's going to be an awesome year.
The spice expands consciousness.
I'm your host, Brooks Agnew.
The spice is vital to space travel.
X Squared Radio is vital to space travel. We're glad you've tuned in and are getting squared. We have some very excellent news stories this hour. Our guest last hour was Sandra Sabatini with the Pythagoras Conference. Doing an awesome job out there as an entrepreneur, leading the way. You're going to travel without moving, recline your chair, look out the window, because we're going to launch the final hour of X Squared Radio, January 22nd, 2012. Welcome back to the program. By the way, as you're making your plans for this year, don't forget, it's 2012. December 21st, 2012 is going to be an amazing time, because December 13th, 2012, we are heading down to Chichen Itza with the Maya at Maya 2012. Don't forget to go to X Squared Radio, click on the orange banner. You want to do something really big, really big. That's the conference to go to. Pythagoras Conference in October and Chichen Itza with us. Santana and Sting in December. It's going to be awesome. Everybody knows it's going to be amazing. That's right. That's right. It's going to be superb. I know. I know. This is really what makes America great. The ability to dream, the ability to hope, the ability to choose for ourselves our future. That's right. I know. I know. You agree with me. That's good. I'm glad. Lots of listeners out there. Lots of listeners. We appreciate you all. Life has been spotted on Venus. It's true. It just came out yesterday. Russian scientist, Moscow. Several objects resembling living beings were detected on photographs taken by a Russian landing probe in 1982 during a Venus mission, says an article published in the Solar System Research magazine. Leonid Kasanformalditi of the Space Research Institute of Russia's Academy of Sciences published a research that analyzed the photographs from the Venus mission made by a Soviet landing probe, Venus 13, in 1982, 30 years ago. The photographs feature several objects which Kasanformalditi said resemble a disc, a black flap, and a scorpion. All of them emerge, fluctuate, and disappear. Now, this isn't real-time film. This is like a sampling of a photo, a sampling of a photo, and then it's sent to Earth and then analyzed. So this isn't like a real-time video off your iPhone. But on a planet that's not occupied, things don't just show up, fluctuate, and disappear, the scientist said, referring to their changing location on different photographs and traces on the ground. He says, what if we forget about the current theories about the non-existent of life on Venus? Let's boldly suggest that the object's morphological features would allow us to say that they are living, close quote. The magazine quoted Kasanformalditi as saying, no data proving the existence of life on Venus, where the ground temperature is 464 degrees Celsius, that's pretty warm, has ever been found. Kasanformalditi's conclusions will not be taken seriously by astronomers because Venus, a planet with a thick atmosphere and an atmospheric pressure of 92 times that on the surface of Earth, and a temperature as high as 894 degrees Fahrenheit, is not considered a serious candidate for extraterrestrial life. Well, how do you know? The planet may have once had bodies of water, but scientists agree there have been no oceans on the planet for at least 2 billion years. Well, what about 1982? That's less than 2 billion years ago. Adding to the skepticism would be the fact that the Venus Express spacecraft has been observing the planet since 2005, and scientists involved in the project have not reported findings suggestive of life on the planet. But some scientists have not ruled out the possibility of microscopic life on Venus in spite of harsh conditions. Regardless of questions about the validity of his conclusions, Kassan Formality has in the past published research papers investigating photographic methods in the search for extraterrestrial life. One of his papers, published in the journal Bioastronomy of the Astronomical Society of the Pacific, described a method for searching for traces of Martian life using holography. Very similar to Andy Basciago's work. As you know, he's done an excellent job of analyzing photographs that were taken by our own rovers. And there's more. As if space hasn't taken on its own life in the last 40 years, one of the things that we have all been ignored, except, of course, from Earth, is the moon. And there's no doubt that China is on the move in space, including the country's own human spaceflight missions to Earth orbit. And at a time when NASA's own budget and big space decisions remain in the to-be-determined column, last November, that's just 2 months ago, China accomplished its first unpiloted space rendezvous and docking test between the country's Chang'e 1, that means Heavenly Palace Space Lab Module, and Shenzhou 8 spaceship. Follow-up flights to the space lab by crewed spacecraft are on the books, all in preparation for China to develop a larger space station. Notice this is not an international space station. In the near future, a major space project that could serve as a testing ground for human treks to the moon. That's right. The country also recently unveiled its blueprints for future space explorations in a white paper entitled China's Space Activities in 2011, which was released in late December by China's Information Office of the State Council. In addition to taking a detailed look at China's space achievements to date, the report offers a glimpse into where the spacefaring nation appears to be headed. You remember the United States in the early 60s at the inspiration of John F. Kennedy said, "We will put a man on the moon in this decade." Well, 6 years later, it was done. Well, times were good in the U.S. then. Taxes had been cut. Interest rates were low. Capital was plentiful. The government wasn't competing against the people for money. And there was lots of enthusiasm and optimism in society. And whenever you have a society that's that in that state, they begin to access the instinctive urge to explore. And explore we did all the way to the moon. China has launched 3 crewed space flights, each more ambitious than the last, since 2003. That's less than a little over 9 years. In the new white paper, major future goals include plans for a robust space transportation system, Earth satellites, human space flights, and deep space exploration. The report includes an impressive list of accomplishments, impressive as much for the political will for success demonstrated as the technical achievements. That's pretty interesting. The Chinese do an excellent job in learning from others. No kidding. And I think they do not want us to see themselves. They do not want to see themselves in NASA's position. Who would? a position of having lots of good ideas, but more rhetorical political support than actual funding to follow through on those ideas. Well, that's the way it is with every single industry in America. We no longer make computer chips here. We no longer make electric cars here. We no longer make airplanes here. There are lots of things for which we have great ideas, wonderful, cutting-edge, disruptive technologies, but no funding. That funding is in China. Under tasks, China's number one priority is getting their heavy-lift Long March 5 rocket operational. Until that is done, all the other big plans will be on hold. Task number three, China says, is to conduct studies on the preliminary plan for a human lunar landing. Translation, to conduct studies on the preliminary plans for a Chinese lunar landing. This acknowledges the eventual intent to put a Chinese astronaut on the moon, something most Americans have long assumed already officially approved and in the works. Also in the document, the Chinese provide an extensive list of international cooperation partners with positive mention made of working with NASA, though they are acutely aware of congressional roadblocks in place to stifle any U.S.-China cooperation. Why is that? Because our space program is run not by NASA, but by the military. And we are not about to share any of our military technology with those with whom we feel ourselves in competition. Overall, this is a report they can, and I'm sure they do, rightly take pride in. It also tacitly points out the need for NASA to move forward with the space launch system. The race is on, and China is not doing anything the U.S. couldn't or hasn't done. But space development appears more important to China now than it has, than it is to the U.S. Well, I take exception with that. Space exploration is extremely important to the U.S. It's important to Americans. Lunar exploration and exploitation is more important to Americans than ever. It just isn't being done by our government. The Chinese emphasis on space for innovation and economic development ought to resonate as much in the U.S. as it does in China. And it does. It does resonate in the U.S. as it does in China. We just don't do anything about it. Which brings us to the next story about the mysterious X-37B. Hang on one moment while I have a sip of my lovely cranberry drink. Nice and refreshing. By the way, 17-17, Giants, 49ers. Not very much time left in the fourth quarter. Two great teams working it out on the football field. I'm excited to see it. I love the struggle. I love the competition. I love the skill. All right, the mysterious X-37B, the United States Air Force's secretive X-37B space plane. You remember where it came from, right? If you listen to this program on a regular basis, we covered it a little bit last year, but just a really quick update. NASA had been working on an unmanned replacement for the space shuttle. It's a smaller, sleeker, less expensive, unmanned version of the space shuttle. Well, long story short, they were long on ideas and short on money. And the project ran into funding problems and testing problems, and they couldn't get it done. In walks the Air Force, which, as you know, NASA is headed up by the military. Almost all of the participants in the space program have been Air Force or Navy pilots. A few civilian scientists have been invited in, but even they have to undergo rigorous training. The bottom line is that the Air Force swooped in, loved the X-37B, put it on its rapid deployment program, which meant it had unlimited budgets, unreported to the public, and before you know it, the X-37B was done and was circling the Earth for more than 10 months, and there's no telling when it might come down. And there was more to this story. Last fall, the other unmanned X-37B space plane changed orbit suddenly, throwing off trackers for a few days. It then landed. It landed safely without any announcement. Another X-37B, the OTV-2, launched and has been in orbit. The OTV-1 launched April of 2010, landed in December of that year, staying on orbit for 225 days, well under the unmanned spacecraft's supposed 270-day limit. No reason was given for cutting it short. But the OTV-2 has already exceeded that limit by more than 7 weeks, and the calendar keeps turning over. As of this last Friday, the mysterious robotic X-37B spacecraft, number 2, has been aloft for 321 days, significantly outlasting its stated mission design lifetime of 270 days, but it may stay up for even longer yet, experts say, particularly if the military views this space mission, the second ever for the hush-hush vehicle, as something of an endurance test. Just what the X-37B does for so long while circling our planet remains a mystery, because the space plane's payloads and missions are classified. Partly as a result of the secrecy, some concern has been raised, particularly by Russia and China, that the X-37B might be a space weapon of some sort. But the Air Force has repeatedly denied that charge, claiming that the vehicle's chief task is testing out new technologies for future satellites. That's likely to be the case, said Whedon, who published a report in 2010 that investigated the X-37B and its likely missions. The Air Force does not disclose the X-37B's orbital parameters, but amateur observers like heavensabove.com have tracked the movements of both OTV-1 and OTV-2. They found that OTV-2 is not looping around Earth in a polar orbit, which enables a good look at every spot on the globe. The interesting thing is that it is at about 100 degrees off from the Tiangong Chinese Space Station, meaning the odds of getting a good look at that craft close up by the X-37B are next to nothing. Something else is of extreme interest up there, but I'm sure that we will never know. And this week and last week, we have had heavy and strange snowstorms. First, they started in Alaska, Portland, and Seattle. But tornadoes in January? A major early season severe weather outbreak will take shape tonight, spanning about a dozen states from the deep south to the Ohio Valley. Some of the thunderstorms are even expected to spawn tornadoes, making for an especially dangerous situation, giving the veil of night. Several factors will come together for this rare, significant January severe weather event. A cold front marking the leading edge of colder air will slice into an unusually warm and moist air mass. The threat for twisters will come via a powerful and rotating blast of air arriving in the upper levels of the atmosphere. While a widespread tornado outbreak is not anticipated, the enhanced threat existing tonight is certainly noteworthy. A few destructive long-track tornadoes are quite possible. Keep in mind that the counterclockwise Keep in mind that the counterclockwise rotation of this huge system is pulling cold air down from Canada, and the height of the structure of the storm reaches up into the lower stratosphere. This is the predicted pattern of a superstorm. Remember that? Super cold air blasting into a warm, moist land hurricane. Result? Surprise snowstorm, capable of dumping 6 to 8 feet of snow. In Alaska, the same pattern dropped 20 feet of snow in 2 days. Record snow in Seattle, and it's still early winter. Strange stuff going on in the winter. So if you're in the upper Midwest or you're in the deep South, stay tuned to your weather channel. Lots of stuff happening in the skies above. Strange energies and results of those energies taking place on the earth today. By the way, you remember us about a month ago talking about John Corzine. You remember MF Global? You remember $1.2 billion of depositors' monies being absconded with and mysteriously lost? And Anne Barnhart saying that it's probably more like $3 billion? Well, somebody's finally taking some action. Montana farmers have filed a class action suit against former New Jersey Governor John Corzine, charging that the failed financial firm run by Corzine stole millions from their accounts to pay off its spiraling debts, and that Corzine's single-minded obsession with making MF Global a big player on Wall Street led to the firm's collapse. MF Global's clients, get this, included 38,000 wheat farmers, cattle ranchers, and others who, quote, hedged their crop prices by placing millions in MF Global accounts. Those accounts were supposed to be segregated and secure, according to the federal suit, meaning MF Global could not draw on those funds. The lawsuit, filed on behalf of all 38,000 customers, alleges that when MF Global made a series of bad investments, notably in European debt, it began siphoning funds withdrawn from segregated client accounts to cover its debts. Siphoning is a fancy word for stealing. MF Global stole funds, the cash that was deposited in MF Global accounts under their names. They stole it to cover its debts. Quote, "This is a suit by the real victims of MF Global," said plaintiff's attorney Mark Baker of the law firm Anderson, Baker & Swanson. He goes on to say the missing funds were not investments in MF Global or loans to MF Global, but rather the customers' own money as collateral to guarantee their contracts. They were not to be used by others, let alone their own broker, to speculate on risky and exotic securities. By the time that story is done, Earth Explorers, it's going to be $3 billion. Corzine was at the helm of the firm when it declared Chapter 11 on October 31st, the eighth largest bankruptcy filing in U.S. history. Regulators initially thought $600 million in customer funds had gone missing, but later upped their estimate to $1.2 billion. Only 60% of customer funds could even be found. The Montana complaint takes square aim at Corzine himself, alleging that the former governor longed to make MF Global a Wall Street powerhouse through a series of risky investments. The lawsuit says Corzine, a former CEO of Goldman Sachs, had a single-minded obsession when he took over in early 2010. But Corzine was reckless in his zeal, according to plaintiff's attorneys. Instead, trading in the risky debt of European countries, MF Global grew not through sound business, but rather, alleges the complaint, through Corzine's political lobbying and the commingling and looting of customers' segregated accounts. Once over $1.2 billion in customer accounts was unaccounted for, the defendants were quick to bury their heads deep in the sand, the lawsuit claims. According to the February issue of Vanity Fair, Corzine, who reportedly made over $16 million personally between 2010 and 2011, was shopping for a chateau in France with his wife 2 weeks before MF Global filed for bankruptcy. Testifying before the House Agriculture Committee in December, Corzine said he had no idea where the $1.2 billion in missing customer funds had gone, and that investigators are still untangling what happened. Later in the month, he appeared before the Senate Agriculture Committee to deny any wrongdoing. Quote, "I never directed anyone at MF Global to misuse customer funds. I never intended to. And as far as I'm concerned, I never gave instructions that anyone could misconstrue," said Corzine. Well, this is how it goes, people. When you put your money in the bank, and these are wheat farmers, several generations of people handing land down from grandfather to father to son. They're growing wheat. They're the world's breadbasket. But as you know, wheat prices are volatile. And so they took profits from years past when times were good, and they hedged in case something happened. Bad weather, long snows that make the wheat rot instead of sprouting and growing in the spring. Wind. Competitive markets like, say, a glut of wheat in Russia. So they hedge that by putting money in interest-bearing accounts to cover their crops. And MF Global saw all that money sitting there, and they couldn't resist. They stole it, and they gambled it, and they lost. And Corzine should go to jail. And the reason that MF Global showed up first is because they were over 100% margined. That is to say that they used 10% of the money to margin out 90% more money, so that when it went under big time. Ann Barnhart says this is just the tip of the iceberg. Within 12 months, we will see the rest of the House of Cards fall. Keep in mind that that was October 31st, 2011, just a few months ago. In the coming months, you're going to see other brokerage houses who did exactly the same thing that Corzine did, only to a lesser degree. Maybe they only margined 90% or they margined 80%. They're a little further down the tip of the iceberg, but it's all going to fall. This has all been put in place because of a Securities and Exchange Commission that is turning a blind eye to these kinds of activities. Without the Securities and Exchange Commission watching these kinds of activities, they might be watching it, but they don't care. They don't care because that $16 million that Corzine made, the friends of the SEC are making that much too. They're going after small business. They're not going after the big guys like these guys. And if they don't send the indictments, they don't send the request for indictment to the Department of Justice, the good old Department of Justice doesn't do anything about it either. Now, these two organizations, the Securities and Exchange Commission and the Department of Justice, are both led by appointees, not elected, not chosen by a committee, appointed by one man, Obama. This article from the Washington Times says, after all these years, it took a great constitutional scholar who had spent a life cloistered in academia and street work to utterly rape our most cherished Constitution. This business of bypassing the Senate to pick recess appointees to positions most Americans have never heard of may seem trivial, It is anything but. What Barack Obama has done has been to disembowel the U.S. Senate and shred the most carefully worded document in the history of civilized society. Recess appointment powers were designed by the founders as a way to fill important Senate-confirmed positions back in the days when the Senate would be out of session for months at a time. It was never intended as a way to skip confirmation in a Senate so deeply divided on a president's nominees that it simply could not agree to confirm them. Shattering precedent, Mr. Obama is now installing his henchmen to Senate-confirmed positions without the advice and consent of the Senate, as explicitly stipulated by the Constitution and explicitly directed by the very laws that created those positions. The very constitutional tenets he tossed out to make these appointments are the only tenets that require the president to seek Senate approval of Supreme Court nominees. What is to stop Mr. Obama now, or any future president, from simply recess appointing thugs to the Supreme Court in order to uphold his socialist platform? During the previous administration, a minority of Democrats in the Senate stalled dozens of nominees to the federal courts. For some, they steadfastly refused for years on end to give a final up or down vote. There was endless idle chatter in Senate hallways of breaking the impasse in various ways that would strain the Constitution. But it always came down to a deep reverence for the document and a larger system that slavishly protects the minority. And Republicans knew that one day they would again be in that minority. What Mr. Obama has done here, though, doesn't just strain the Constitution. He has torn right through it. What he says, when he says it is all supportable by the Constitution, he is lying. There is simply no other explanation for such a learned scholar to say such a thing. Unless he is learned, yet illiterate, which is entirely possible considering the perniciousness of affirmative action at places like Harvard Law School. Whether it is staining our Constitution, killing U.S. citizens with his beloved drones, or drowning us in taxes and Orwellian health regulations, Barack Obama has become our homegrown enemy. He shreds the Constitution with the unflinching calmness of a suicide bomber, uncaring that he is destroying the only system on earth that could have given him the life and success he has enjoyed, thinking only of the martyrdom that will come through his annihilation of what is important to others. So where are the so-called liberal voices of outrage? Are they so high on the elixir of power that they no longer care for the minority or the only refuge on earth where they are protected? Or have their principled souls been lost in partisan bloodthirst? It was no mistake that Mr. Obama chose the very day of the Iowa Republican caucuses to leak word of his decision to rescind the Constitution. It was a hellfire warning of what is to come, and that he will stop at nothing to advance his socialist agenda. Now come this crew of hopeless pikers with their little wooden arrows and plastic swords, debating endlessly about which one will be chosen by Republicans to slay the monster. With every passing day, confidence drains away. Is Mitt Romney capable of meeting such ruthlessness? Does Rick Santorum have the sinful hatred in his heart to match this? Is it possible Newt Gingrich won't self-destruct in the face of such diabolical scheming? Can Ron Paul's heart of gold survive another 5 minutes watching as the Constitution is ripped asunder? You decide. We have a chance, maybe the last chance in a generation to take back what was built over 200 years ago. A system so pure, so inspired, so solid that it is the oldest constitution on the planet. It works, and it is being torn apart, not corner by corner, right down the middle, by one man. We have a chance to make a change. We had a record turnout in South Carolina yesterday. Record. We also have another record. We have a caucus and two primaries, a winner of each one. Three winners, three states, as Rick Santorum said. Yes, it is an amazing country, but these are amazing times. And the people realize we need all of our champions. Now, a little bit more back to space exploration, our final story of tonight, maybe. You know the moon Titan, right? Saturn's moon Titan. Well, physicist Jason Barnes was just 6 years old in 1982 when scientists first came up with the Cassini spacecraft mission that would tour Saturn's rings and moons more than two decades later. Now, a fully grown Barnes has the even wilder idea of sending a robotic aircraft soaring through the skies of Saturn's mysterious moon, Titan. Called the Aviator, it is a drone design that looks eerily similar to those of U.S. military drones patrolling the skies above Earth's battlefields, but it could fly through Titan's skies far more easily than those of Earth. The Saturn moon has seven times less gravity and more than three times denser atmosphere to give wings extra lift. That would allow the drone to stay airborne almost forever on nuclear batteries with two light bulbs worth of power as it scouts the surface of Titan. He says because it would be electrically powered by advanced Stirling radioisotope generators, we could theoretically go forever on that power, said Barnes, a physicist at the University of Idaho. By the way, Idaho is at the leading edge of a lot of stuff, you know. They're the first ones to build a wind farm. They're the first ones to build a large solar area. And they've been leading in a lot of the nuclear stuff as well. He goes on to say, the nominal mission is a year, but we don't really have an upper limit. We could maintain flight indefinitely. A robotic airplane could fly on Titan more efficiently than a hot air balloon, says Barnes and his colleagues. It could also swoop below Titan's atmospheric haze and take detailed images of the moon's surface that usually lies hidden from the cameras of Cassini or other spacecraft in orbit. Flying an aircraft on a moon of Saturn where methane falls as rain may seem wildly futuristic, but the drone doesn't require much new technology. One of the Aviator drone designers, Richard Folk, of the Naval Research Laboratory, has already created tens of drones for the U.S. Navy. We're really taking advantage of the fact that the Defense Department has spent tens of billions of dollars to create the technology we need. The drone would enter Titan's atmosphere in an aero shell, similar to the one that protected the Huygens probe dropped by Cassini in 2005. Once a parachute had deployed to really slow down the descent, the aircraft would unfold its wings tucked beneath it, turn on the propeller, and fly out of the aero shell. The power source is one of the few exceptions for new technologies. The ASRG, being developed by NASA, would resemble more efficient versions of existing nuclear batteries that harness energy from radioactive decay of materials such as plutonium-238. That still only amounts to about 250 watts or two light bulbs worth of power for Aviator. The power supply limits how much information the drone can beam back to Earth as well. Rather than load up the drone with extra batteries, the mission designers came up with a clever solution. The aviator would climb to about 8.7 miles up in Titan's atmosphere, stop its propeller, and then redirect all power to the upload beam as it glides down to just 2 miles above the moon's surface. The drone is expected to beam about 1 gigabyte of data about Titan's methane rainfall, winds, clouds, and other weather information back to Earth within a year, the equivalent of about 200 songs in MP3 format. A side view camera would reveal views of Titan's clouds stretching out across the horizon. Aviator would also carry a high-resolution camera, similar to the one on the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, capable of imaging objects as small as 10 inches per digital image pixel. That would allow it to take images at the peak of its climb to build a mosaic map of Titan's surface, even as it also captured high-resolution images at the bottom of its glide. As it got about 2 miles above, it could take much, much sharper images. It is a proposed $715 million budget. New Frontiers missions must target scientific targets deemed high priority by the Planetary Science Decadal Survey, but Titan was not on the menu for the most recent round. Now Barnes has settled in for a career-long quest to build up support for Titan in the year 2019, so that a mission might launch in the late 2020s. Hopefully we're going to the moon before then. And also on a more nefarious note, I'm trying to see who won the football game. Looks like New York might have won. I think so. The Giants may have, in fact, beaten. Yes, they did. They beat the 49ers. The Giants are going to the Super Bowl. So it looks like the vice president was right. There may, on a more nefarious note, there may have been foul play with the Russians. Foul play may be responsible for the result of Russia's Mars probe Phobos Grunt. You remember the one that just landed in the Pacific last weekend? The 14.5-ton spacecraft got stuck in Earth orbit shortly after its November 8th launch, and it crashed in the ocean. It's unclear why our setbacks often occur when the vessels are traveling through what, for Russia, is the dark side of Earth, in areas where we do not see the craft and do not receive its telemetry readings, Popovkin told Russia's Izvestia newspaper, according to Agence France Presse. I don't want to blame anyone, but today there are some very powerful countermeasures that can be used against spacecraft whose use we cannot exclude. Russian engineers still don't know why Phobos Grunt's main engines failed to fire as planned to send the probe on its way toward Mars, Popovkin said. But he admitted that the mission was risky to begin with since it was underfunded and relied on old Soviet-era designs. We remember the Russians have sent two previous probes to the moon. One was inadvertently shut off on the way to Mars and couldn't be turned back on. And the other one made it to the moon, Phobos, orbited Phobos, took photographs of Phobos, and its last picture was of a missile headed straight for it, which knocked it out of the sky. Interesting stuff. And in our final piece, you know, there are challenges out there. Going to Mars, building some housing on Mars. And there are some pretty cool habitats that people are talking about out there, about going to Mars. And I think it's a lot of hooey. I mean, yes, it would be kind of nice to go to Mars, but it's 43 million miles away. Don't you think it would be smart to build these habitat demonstration units for deep space use on the moon first? Build them on the moon, 3 days away. On the moon or Mars, astronauts will be exposed to cosmic rays that damage human tissue when absorbed by the body. Solar flares, a more sudden and unpredictable burst of radiation, can kill instantaneously. NASA is investigating ways to build an electrostatic radiation shield to protect astronauts. For now, however, the easiest solution is surrounding them with materials that absorb the onslaught of energy. This means carefully choosing what materials to use in the habitat's shell, but it will also determine how many objects are arranged in the interior, because you're going to be using up a lot of space and a lot of weight, especially if you're going to use lead. But if you put the habitats on the moon and you make use of the volcanic vents on the moon, you can get out of the way of all this radiation just a few yards beneath the soil or on a very oblique angle, something that points toward the Earth at all times, like the side of the moon that faces the Earth all the time. And you don't really have to worry about those solar blasts, because the magnetosphere of the Earth will deflect and make weak any direct hits from the moon to the moon. And if the moon is being illuminated by the sun and not eclipsed by the Earth, then the attack angle will be oblique, and the photons and high energy beams will never even hit the habitat a few yards below the mouth of one of these openings. Come on, guys. This is simple engineering. You need me to come down there and show you how to do it? That's what I'm talking about. There are 100 billion planets out there, around 100 billion stars in the Milky Way. A lot of them, 3,000 to 25,000 of them, are probably habitable within traveling distance of Earth. And the only way to get there is to have a heavy lift ability from Earth, which is not very likely, or a heavy lifting ability from the moon, which is very likely. A lot cheaper to lift something from the moon, or at least get it to the moon, put it together in bigger pieces, and then launch it from the moon, because you got about 1/4 to 1/6 the gravity that you have here on the Earth. Just interesting thoughts, people. Come on. We can put it together. We could make it happen. So next week is the 29th of January. It's one of those rare months when we have five Sundays in 1 month. So the 29th of January is next Sunday. We're probably going to have a program. I'm going to be traveling, putting some things together for you-know-what. So I will be at an undisclosed location between you-know-where and you-know-where, because I'm doing something that we don't want you-know-who to find out about. We don't want them to stop us from doing what we're doing. So I want you to tune in, because it could be a very interesting program. We may do it on the road. We may be at an undisclosed location, but you will be here with us. By the way, if you've been trying to listen to the Rico Paganini broadcast on November 6th, it is now fixed. So you can go back and listen to that piece about the Giza legacy. I highly recommend it. Thank you so much for being part of X Squared Radio. We will see you next week. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.